and by the Celtic clan of Kent, who have graciously agreed to provide all of the music for our service this morning.
Traditions, a link to the past, brought into the present, to be shared with the future. We light our chalice this morning in celebration of sharing traditions.
Celtic music has a tradition of celebrating the beauty of love and nature. You'll hear a couple of those songs later. There's also a long history of story songs, many of which end rather badly and can be a bit violent. I've changed some of the lyrics of one of those story songs called The Wild Colonial Boy, you can guess what that was like, to reduce the violence and introduce a little bit of humor. This resulted in a story called The Mild Colonial Boy. There was a mild colonial boy, Jack Dugan was his name. He was born and raised in Ireland, in a place called Castlemaine. He was his father's only son, his mother's pride and joy. And dearly did his parents love that mild colonial boy. At the early age of 60 years, he left his native home. And through Australia's sunny clime, he was inclined to roam. He was a kindly vegan, strange methods did employ, releasing farmers' livestock and then planting their fields with soy. For two long years, this daring youth ran on his mild career. With a heart that knew no danger, farmers' wrath he did not fear. He grew more bold with every day. He robbed Judge McElroy, who trembling gave his goose up to that mild colonial boy. One morning on the prairie, young Jack Dugan rode along while listening to the mockingbirds and singing a cheerful song. Out jumped three farmers, fierce and grim, Kelly, Davis, and Fitzroy. They'd all set out to capture him, that mild colonial boy. Surrender now, Jack Dugan, you can see there's 3-1. Surrender in the Queen's name, sir, you vegetarian. Jack drew two chickens from his coat and proudly held them high. You'll never eat these birds, declared that mild colonial boy. He threw an egg at Kelly, spattering yolk across his crown. He nimbly got past Davis, too, and made for higher ground. But a fleeing pullet tripped him, and he was nabbed by Fitzroy. And that is how they captured him, that mild colonial boy.
Thank you, Don. New ways and old. New choices always seem so good at first. Heralding a way of being in the world, happy, energetic, focused. Soon, though, something within begins to grumble and draws the spirit back to the old way. What to do with the grumbling something? To persuade it that it's okay to feel so good. The new way says, let it be and love it. Of course, the old way will have none of that. Gradually, year by year, the old way retires. The new way creeps in, and the spirit persists.
Rituals and traditions are extremely important aspects of our lives, as even the simplest of rituals can hold great meaning. We're going to talk a bit about family traditions this morning, but I think that everything that we'll end up talking about can be related to any group of people who care about each other or who consider themselves members of a shared community. Family traditions and rituals are things that only your family does. It might be a special song that's sung at mealtime, or a certain way that stories are read at bedtime, or special procedures around decorating your home for the holiday season. Or it might be your own rules, family rules for playing a certain game, or code words that only your family knows. These rituals and traditions help us feel that we belong and that they communicate who we are. Often they are handed down from generation to generation. They strengthen our bonds and strengthen our shared values. So who would like to share a family ritual of theirs? Just a few words about what they do, something that they do over and over that belongs to them. Who would like to share? At dinner at Caroline's, they each tell the best and the worst part of the day. They always sing the same lullaby at bedtime. Cheryl?
Yeah.
At Cheryl's, they put up a special antique manger. I'm going to take two more. Larry? Or Wally, excuse me. Every day he argues with his, all right, with his higher power. And Cameron? Every Christmas morning, Cameron's family has kookin' together. So these are all great examples. One more. Isabella. Oh, your special family song. And Isabella's family, they have a special birthday song that they sing. So these are great examples, and I can imagine that people are getting some good ideas about what new rituals and traditions they might develop for their families. But what happens when circumstances change, time passes, young children become tweens and teenagers, and they would rather Saturday night be sleep overnight rather than pizza and a movie with the family night? What happens when that child no longer wants to be read a bedtime story, but would rather choose their own reading material and read independently? What happens to rituals and traditions when the family configuration changes? Perhaps the parents are no longer together and there are now two homes. What happens when the older teens go to college and move from the family home? What happens when those rituals and traditions no longer seem to hold the same meaning? Now, in my family, we took a photograph of my daughter every first day of school and every last day of school in the same place in our yard. And we did this until she went off to college. And even though we no longer do this, of course, we still talk about it and we remember it fondly, and it's still a part of who we are, although we do not do it. But now we do some different things and we try different things. And if those things don't resonate with us, then that's okay. We try something else. Now, does anyone have an example of how their family has adapted a ritual or a tradition? How about you, Leah? So Leah and her daughter say a prayer before she leaves and comes back from her father's home. And at Trisha's, they invite non-family members to the holiday dinners. So it takes some doing to change and alter and adapt our traditions. But adapting our rituals is worth the effort, because no matter what our age, these rituals remain important bonds in our most significant relationships. And now we'll sing our teachers and the children to their classrooms. Remember, we sing twice. We move on the second time through.
To lead us into a time of silence and meditation or prayer, words from Angela Herrera, a Unitarian Universalist minister in New Mexico. Lucky streak. Who cast a spell over my world? Who opened the doors, stirred the crowd of possibilities, put gold dust in my dreams, causing my life to turn? O fate, O love, O spirit, O God, is it true that all good things must end? Or have you set me on a path of meaning, not luck, of clarity, not magic? And this grace that brought me to the mountaintop is also a sign to carry me through dark forests of loss, the ones that await us all, that disturb our peaceful sleep. The same grace that guides the seasons, cracking the ice, pushing up saplings, scattering the earth with their first dramatic leaves. And I invite you to join with me now in the spirit of prayer. Mm-hmm. This is the day that we have been given. Every day we awake is another opportunity to say those words. This is the day that we have been given. It wasn't promised. We can't control it. It was given as a gift, with all the fullness that the gift entails. So much fullness, our hearts can scarcely contain it at times. They break open with the pain and the joy of these lives of ours. This is the day that we have been given. May we recognize, even in the trying times, that we have been handed a most precious gift. Not because it was promised or because we earned it, simply because there's mystery there. May we bow before the mystery, lift our hearts in praise and gratitude, and say with feeling, this is the day that we have been given. Let us rejoice and be glad in it. Amen.
It is I who must begin. It is I who must begin. Once I begin, once I try, here and now, right where I am, not excusing myself by saying things would be easier elsewhere without grand speeches or ostentatious gestures, but all the more persistently to live in harmony with the voice of being as I understand it within myself. As soon as I begin that, I suddenly discover, to my surprise, I am neither the only one nor the first nor the most important one to have set out upon that road. Whether all is really lost or not depends entirely whether or not I am lost. A.J. Jacobs is a writer who chooses to immerse himself in his topics. He sees his life as a series of experiments. In his book, My Year of Living Biblically, he undertook the task of following all the rules of the Bible. He found there were 700 rules or laws in the Bible. One of the more well-known, be fruitful and multiply, he accomplished by having twins during his biblical year. A more arcane and obscure law states that you cannot shave the corners of your beard. Not knowing the location of the corners of his beard, he did not shave for the entire year. The result was a very full, bushy beard, and he relates that his wife would not kiss him for the last 2 months of his biblical beard. Wearing biblical clothing, sandals and a white robe, and posing for a picture with a staff and a he learned many valuable lessons during the year. Probably the most important one was, thou shalt not take the Bible literally. In summing up his TED Talk, he shares his thoughts about rituals and traditions.
So a year of trying to follow all of the laws and rules in the Bible, and this is one of his major conclusions, that rituals are irrational. There are lots of differences between the meanings of the words rituals and traditions, but lots of people use them interchangeably, and so I will too, for just a moment to test his conclusion. Think for a moment about the traditions that you keep. Consider some of the ones that we heard earlier in the service, or just think about your own family's patterns. So by a show of hands, would you agree that some of your traditions are best understood as expressions of emotion and connection rather than as examples of rational, reasoned thought? Yes. Okay. So this is an important point to make right away. When we're talking about traditions, we're not always talking about the rational. Instead, we're talking often about feelings and relationships. And as we know, feelings are not always rational. In fact, are not often rational. And relationships are always changing. Therefore, it only stands to reason that our traditions are going to need to change over our lifetimes too. And even when that change is welcome, it isn't always easy. So let's take young adulthood for an example. When you were a young adult, how did you decide what traditions to keep? As children, most of us just go along with the traditions of our families of origin, for better or for worse. And then for most of us, there comes a time when we're faced with a choice. If we aren't going to do exactly what our family of origin did, well, then what are we going to do? I remember so clearly the first Thanksgivings and Christmases that I spent away from my family of origin. And I remember feeling both free and totally bereft at the exact same time. Free to choose for myself what I was going to do, how I was going to keep these holidays, and bereft of the comfort and security that comes of being swept up by the familiar traditions I could only take part in by being at home. It seems like there's this life cycle to traditions. We grow up with the traditions created by our families, and then as adults, we either adapt those traditions or create new ones which endure for a time. Those who have children get to be in charge for a while, creating the traditions, and then their children become adults and a new cycle emerges. Things change, and then they change again when grandchildren are born. Or maybe there are no children, but single adults and coupled adults whose lives are also changing with weddings and divorces, births and deaths, long-distance moves, and changes in health. Whatever the circumstances, they're sure to involve change. And when things change, we often find that our traditions need to change too. There's a great blog that I learned about recently, written by two licensed mental health professionals who specialize in bereavement, called What's Your Grief? They wrote an essay last November about the process of navigating family traditions during the holidays after the death of a loved one. They begin by acknowledging that traditions are part of what shapes our identities, part of what binds us to people and creates shared meaning. So when a loved one dies, their absence may strip certain traditions of their meaning or make other traditions just too painful to keep. They suggest that it's best for families to face this process directly and together and evaluate together what to do with the beloved family traditions. They recommend calling a meeting of all the people who need to be involved, from the youngest to the oldest, and discussing the traditions one by one prior to the holiday. Given their beloved's death, should they keep this tradition, modify it, or skip it entirely? None of the options are easy. If a family keeps a tradition, keeping it will call to their attention their loved one's absence. If they modify it, the fact of modifying it will call to their attention their loved one's absence and the need for a change. It will reflect their loss that they have made a change. And if they eliminate it entirely, the disruption will be a symbol that everything has changed. None of this is comfortable, but all of it is an opportunity for honoring the ties that bind us to the living and connect us to our beloved dead. And we could say similar things about other life circumstances, like divorce. We have beautiful and time-honored traditions for recognizing couples when they wed. But when they divorce, it's so often publicly marked by little more than the fact of physical separation and legal paperwork. I wonder how our lives would be different if we had traditions for recognizing divorce, at least in those circumstances where the relationship hasn't been completely damaged by anger or mired in violence. What if people who were divorcing brought some of their closest friends and family together to help them in a ritual remember what was good about the relationship and why they wed in the first place, and what beautiful things came out of their union together, and then acknowledging that it was time to part? Or what if we had a tradition of married couples performing some kind of ritual to unmarry, to thank one another for the good times, to forgive one another for their mistakes, and ritually, symbolically set each other free to begin again? If we had traditions like that, I think it might be a little easier for those who had divorced, and especially for any children of divorced families, to create new traditions and new family constellations. I think traditions like that would help people do some of the emotional and spiritual work that it takes to open up to a new way. And we might say similar things about after recovery from addiction, or after the diagnosis of a major mental health challenge or disability, or after the onset of mental illness, or after bankruptcy, or after trauma of so many kinds. When our lives change in these dramatic ways, our traditions usually need to change to reflect our altered circumstances. So how do we do this? How do we create new traditions? I think we do it by giving ourselves the time and the space it takes to live into the changes. I think we do it by recognizing that our traditions are emotional and spiritual and not simply rational, and making space in our hearts and in our spirits to hear the wisdom that's calling us into the future. Angela Herrera says that we do it with the gift of grace. And this grace that brought me to the mountaintop, she says, is also a sign to carry me through the dark forests of loss, the ones that await us all. New traditions don't happen all at once. Instead, they crystallize over time as we honor who we are becoming and how we're connected now, and live into new ways of symbolizing the ties that bind us. So far, I've been speaking personally, but I want to acknowledge that there's a public dimension to this too. We have countless traditions in our public lives, some of them so ingrained as normal and natural that it's almost impossible to see them, or at least very difficult, except in retrospect. Looking back, we can see so many ways in which people have challenged traditions and created new ones. I'm thinking at this moment in our public life about Stonewall, of course, and all the courageous souls who challenged the traditions of heterosexuality as the only normative option and the gender binary construct as false and damaging. Saying those things, threatening those traditions, entailed great risk for the people who first did so and for many of those who followed the first ones. But they persevered, and thanks to them, we are finally on the cusp of a new tradition of marriage equality. We pray that we're on the cusp of a new tradition of marriage equality. And though the tradition of pink is for girls and blue is for boys has proved more enduring and a little more difficult to topple, we're at least having more public dialogue about this. I've been astonished in the last year, especially, about how many mainstream publications are carrying articles about the diversity of gender identity amongst people in our world. This seems to me a new moment reflecting the ongoing work that so many people are doing to challenge the tradition of the gender binary construct. And part of our work as religious people who believe in the worth and dignity of all is to stand in solidarity with the trans and genderqueer and genderfluid people who face the greatest risk in speaking out, and proclaim our faith that a new tradition of respect is possible in our country. Looking back, we can see the ways that millions of women in the first and then the second and now the third wave of the women's movement have challenged traditions of what constitutes women's work and women's spheres and women's proper place in society. The new traditions that have been won as a result are a sea change from 100 years ago. And we can hear that in the stories of people who are still our contemporaries. I led a group here at the church a few years ago, a spiritual autobiography group, which had a multi-generational group. And one of the things that was so striking to me as a younger woman was the stories of older women about the risk that it entailed to go to college, or if not, if that was accepted in their families, to choose a major outside of the limited number of options that were sanctioned by the family, or then to live independently without being married. So many things that seem just like the way the world is now were so risky for people just 30 years ago. And because they took those risks and challenged the traditions, we live in a more just and equitable society for women. And I'm thinking also about the ways in which men have challenged the limits of their roles and their identities too, with wonderful new traditions of more equitable relationships with spouses and more fulfilling and engaged roles as fathers. Looking back, we can see how traditions around sexuality have changed dramatically as a result of the sexual revolution in this country. Once upon a time, most people considered it inappropriate for two who intended to be wed to live together before they were wed. And now, I know a lot of parents who say to their children, you need to live together before you get married to make sure you're compatible. Make sure the marriage will last. And lest I make it seem that all new traditions are advancements for society, I want to acknowledge that some are plainly damaging and a major step backward. I read an article recently about the changes in the pornography industry in recent years, and I am startled to find the ways in which misogyny and pornography has become mainstream. It makes it seem like the porn of the 30s and the 40s is not porn in comparison to the misogynist porn that is available freely on the internet today. So we could talk about new traditions when it comes to just about any major social issue in our public lives. And we can recognize that these are always changing because just like our personal lives, our public lives are always changing. The dialogue is always changing. The traditions are always changing. And some of the new public traditions are for the worse, like new traditions that make killing in war so frighteningly efficient today. And some of the new traditions are for the better, like new traditions empowering elder adults to live boldly into elder adulthood and to take their place as sages in our society. And so I'd like to end this sermon by talking a little bit about a new tradition that is still forming in our society and the center of so much public attention. The traditions of slavery and Jim Crow and voter disenfranchisement and redlining and legal and de facto segregation, all once accepted traditions, proudly by many, have created a legacy of inequity for African Americans in our society. And we're living through another current in the tide of the struggle for civil rights and social justice with the emergence of the Black Lives Matter movement. Named and led by young Black people, this movement is forcing our nation to consider once again what it would take to move more fully into a new tradition of equity and justice for African Americans and all people of color. And I have told you what I think about this a lot of times already, so I'm not going to tell you again. But if you're newer to the congregation and don't know, I'll say in a nutshell that my own view is a liberationist view of racial justice, and I'll be glad to tell you in greater detail what that means to me. But the reason that I'm raising this right now is not because it matters what I think. I'm raising it right now because it matters what you think. The question before us is, what do you think about this movement and about the quest for racial justice in our society? And the reason the question is so live is because a member of our congregation has proposed a congregational resolution in support of the Black Lives Matter movement. So if you are a member and you haven't yet read your annual report, I encourage you to do so and to look at this resolution very carefully, because it will be voted upon at our next annual meeting, which is next Sunday. So some members of the congregation have looked at this resolution, and they have shared that they're not very comfortable with it, that it feels provocative in response to a complex issue. And among those who are not in support of the Black Lives Matter resolution as it's currently written is our congregation's Board of Trustees. And so, wanting to affirm that our work is to support the struggle for racial justice and equity, they have proposed an alternative resolution, which will also be considered next Sunday. I hope that you will take the time to carefully consider both of these and to avail yourself of opportunities to discuss your point of view with other people. I'm not saying that there's one right answer. What I'm saying is that what matters, I think, most right now is the process and the conversation that we take as a congregation to think together, to feel together, to notice together what we feel called to do and to be and to say in response to this major public issue of our time. So you can do that. You can begin to participate in the dialogue today after the second service if you'd like to return for a conversation about this resolution. Or you can do that on Friday when we have our congregational information meeting to discuss this, or you can do that in more informal ways with others who are in the congregation. However you choose to do it, I hope that you will, because this is an important conversation and an important moment, and it matters what you think. And as you have these conversations, I encourage you to remember that not all traditions are rational, As A.J. Jacobs tells us, the point is to choose to keep the traditions which do no harm. The tradition of racial injustice we live with now isn't rational. It's clearly rooted in historic feelings of white racial superiority and has done tremendous harm. Racism was built upon white people's feelings of entitlement, entitlement to power and money and privilege, and white people's disregard and indifference to black lives. And so many people say, that was then, so long ago. And that's true, but the legacy persists. The legacy of those traditions persists into this moment, and that's why this movement has arisen. So what perpetuates that inequity now? Why is that legacy active in our public lives today? That's a complicated question. How can we stand in solidarity with people of color and with white people who are working to dismantle those old traditions and call into being a new tradition of justice and equity? That's a complicated question. What's our work as Unitarian Universalists in this moment? At this moment in history, how are we called? Those are the questions behind the question of whether or not you'll support the resolution, and I hope you'll consider them carefully and take the risk to speak your truth, even as you listen carefully to the truth that others have discerned. May we find wisdom between us and the will to discover what solidarity and the struggle for justice and equity means to us now, and the strength and the courage and the will to put what we discover, our faith, into action. Many of you are aware that our Director of Religious Education, Karen Lapidus, is retiring, and we are preparing to present her with a gift from the congregation. This is the last Sunday we're taking your contributions to the gift. They can be notes in writing. You'll find little slips of paper in the pews, which you can place in the offering basket or in the container marked love on the table outside the door. Or we are also accepting monetary donations and gifts of frequent flyer miles or hotel points so that we may give Karen a fitting retirement gift from the congregation. I send you with these words from Barbara Peskin. Because of those who came before, we are. In spite of their failings, we believe. Because of and in spite of the horizons of their vision, we too dream. Go in peace.